Lecture 5, All is Suffering.
In our last lecture, we talked about the life story of the Buddha. We talked about his birth in the kingdom that's now in the region of southern Nepal, and we talked about his renunciation and all of those events that led up to his enlightenment, and finally, of course, to his great teaching career, where he converted quite a large number of people, it seems, in retrospect, and began to put together that community that was the nucleus of the Buddhist tradition. As I mentioned right at the end of the lecture, the death of the Buddha left his followers with a difficult problem. During his life, the Buddha had not only been a source of authority for the community, a source of teaching, a source of discipline and doctrine, and all of those things that made the Buddhist tradition in that time the beginning of a great world religion, but he also had been a focus of veneration and of worship for many of his followers, particularly for his lay followers. So when the Buddha died, he left the realm of rebirth altogether, was no longer reborn in this world, and really, in many respects, was no longer available for any kind of intervention or any kind of worship. What was left to fill the void? That's really the key question. What was left after the Buddha died that could fill the void left by his absence, by his death? Buddhists traditionally have given two answers to this question. For those who wanted to venerate or to worship the Buddha left behind what's called the form body. Initially, this form body was comprised simply of the relics of his cremation. As I mentioned last time, when he died, his body was taken by his lay followers and was wrapped in certain elaborate ways and set up on a cremation pyre and burned. When the fire was out and the cremation was finished, they took the relics of the cremation and distributed them to a number of lay disciples, and these were set up in reliquary mounds to serve as the focus of worship. Over time, any physical representation of the Buddha came to play the same role, including objects that the Buddha touched, places he visited, or even, as time went on, images of the Buddha's form, physical representations of the Buddha's form. In the past, probably around the 3rd or 4th century of the Common Era, one of the most important shrines in the whole Buddhist world was the shrine that was set up in what is now Pakistan to set up as a place of worship, the Buddha's begging bowl. So any object that was associated with the Buddha was potentially a focus of worship. These objects all represent, in one way or another, the form body of the Buddha, his continuing physical presence in this world. For people who wanted to follow the Buddha's example, he left behind what's called his Dharma, his teaching. The teaching that expressed the content of his awakening and showed the way for others to achieve this awakening themselves. Now, out of this distinction, this simple distinction in the Buddhist tradition between the physical body of the Buddha and the body of his teaching, came the distinction between two bodies of the Buddha. If you have studied Christian theology, you know that there was a lot of discussion in the Christian tradition in the early years, in the development of that religion, about the two natures of Christ. Christians say that Christ is fully human and also fully divine. Now, you might imagine that this distinction between the two Buddha bodies is, in a way, similar to that Christian distinction between the human nature of Christ and Christ's divine nature. The Buddha has two bodies, physical body, form body, that arises and passes away, I suppose you could say, like the human nature of Christ. And the Dharma body is eternal and doesn't change. But it's important, actually, not to carry this comparison too far. It's misleading to think that the Buddha is divine in either of these senses, either in a physical sense or in the sense in which we identify the Buddha with his teaching. The Dharma for Buddhists, really, I mean, you have to be frank about this, is beyond the gods. The gods arise and pass away in the Indian tradition, but the Dharma is eternal. And it remains. And in that sense, it's possible to speak of the Buddha, as was done especially later in the Mahayana tradition, as being eternal, in the sense that he has left behind with us, with his community, the body of his teaching. Now, the job that we have now in this lecture is to begin to dig into the content of that teaching, try to understand what the Buddha told his disciples about the nature of the world that allowed them in some way to reproduce in their own experience the experience of his awakening. In the discourse on the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the so-called Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, it gives the account of the Buddha's first sermon. The traditional summary of the teaching is given in four categories, the so-called Four Noble Truths. I'll simply list these for you to start with, and then we'll talk about each one of them in more detail. The first is the truth of suffering, or dukkha. The second, the truth of the arising of suffering. The third is the truth of the cessation of suffering, and here the word is nirvana, a word that I'm sure is familiar to most of you, or nibbana. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. I should say, incidentally, in passing here, as we move through these categories, that I've shifted the language that I'm working with from Sanskrit to a language called Pali. This is the language of the traditional scriptures of Southeast Asia, the scriptures of the Theravada tradition. And you can think of it as a vernacular, a popular form of Sanskrit. It was spoken in one of the regions of India shortly after the death of the Buddha. When we come back to the Mahayana in a later lecture, we'll come back to using Sanskrit because Sanskrit became the standard language in the classical Buddhist tradition shortly after the beginning of the Common Era. Now, you might imagine, as you're listening to me talk about this, you might raise a question about how Pali is related to Sanskrit. There obviously are lots of technical ways you can go from one language to the other, but the way that I tell my students to try to generate the Pali form whenever you know the Sanskrit is to take a box of Kleenex and stuff your mouth with Kleenex and try to pronounce the Sanskrit, and out will come the Pali. We only know one place where this is true right now, the relationship between the word nirvana, which is quite precise, actually. Nirvana, you see, you have to use your tongue in quite a precise way to say that word. But imagine that you've got your mouth stuffed with Kleenex and try to say nibbana, nibbana. You get the Pali. Now, this probably won't help you too much on your first Pali examination in graduate school, but at least it'll help you feel the connection between these two languages. Now, the best place for us to begin, of course, is with the first of these noble truths, the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. Some say that if you understand the truth of suffering, you really understand all of the four noble truths by implication. Now, the truth of suffering is expressed in the simple claim that all is suffering. The phrase here, the Pali phrase, might be worth remembering, is sabbam dukkham. If you're listening to this lecture, you might even want to repeat this phrase, sabbam dukkham. When I talk to my students at Boston University about this, right at the beginning of the semester, everyone's feeling pretty optimistic, actually, about all the things that are going to come in the course of the semester. And I tell them to try to imagine the way they're going to feel when final exams arrive. And they've got a couple of papers due in 2 days. They haven't done the research. Exams are a couple of days later. How do you feel after you've spent all night trying to write a paper? Subum ducum. All is suffering. Say it with a kind of dolorous intensity, with a long face. Subum ducum. All is suffering. Now, this phrase, the first doctrinal assertion that we've discussed so far in the Buddhist tradition, poses a problem for us. It's not easy to interpret. If you know Buddhist people, if you are a Buddhist person, you know that the Buddhist tradition is not filled with sadness. It's not a depressive, downbeat tradition. In many respects, it has a kind of lightness and a kind of buoyancy. Buddhist people, the Dalai Lama, for example, if you've seen him speaking on the television or see him in person, has a certain kind of lightness in his personality that allows him to simply float through the world. He expresses it with a smile. I wish I could somehow capture that exquisite smile of the Dalai Lama for myself and pass it on to you, because it conveys something important about the Buddhist tradition. Buddhism is light, it's buoyant, it's easy. It almost floats as a religious tradition through the complexity of this world. So the basic assertion in the Four Noble Truths, the assertion that all is suffering, poses an interpretive dilemma for us. How do you get from this claim, the claim that all is suffering, to the buoyancy and the lightness of Buddhist experience? That's our challenge. That's the interpretive challenge we have as we first try to step into the world of Buddhist doctrine. The first way to start to answer this question for ourselves is to note that the tradition, the ancient tradition of Buddhist teaching, interprets the phrase all is suffering in three separate ways. Everything is suffering in one or more of three ways. The first of these types of suffering is called dukkha dukkha, suffering suffering. The obvious suffering in situations where things cause you physical or mental pain. The second kind of suffering is called viparinama dukkha, suffering due to transformation or change. This means that even the most pleasurable things, and sometimes the most pleasurable things, can cause you suffering when they begin to change and pass away. The third kind of suffering is samkara dukkha, suffering due to conditioned states. This category of dukkha, of suffering, is associated with pleasurable things that can cause pain even in the midst of the pleasure, if that pleasure is based on an illusion about the nature of the object or even about the nature of the self. Now, when I'm speaking with students at Boston University about these three kinds of suffering, I try to illustrate them by constructing a parable that may sound simply contemporary, but actually it's related in an important way to Buddhist examples that are often used to explain the nature of suffering, especially in its philosophical mode. This is a parable about an automobile, an American automobile. Our classroom at Boston University is often right on the street on Commonwealth Avenue, where there's a lot of traffic. And as you know, if you've been hanging around in universities these days, there are a lot of students who drive fast, impressive automobiles. Boston University, don't tell anybody this, but I think they're often associated with the business school. In any case, they're roaring up and down the avenue in these great black cars with the sound systems blaring. And I've talked to, you know, we look out the window. Usually it's early in the morning. There probably aren't too many cars out there at that point, but we imagine that the cars are roaring up and down the avenue, and we imagine scenarios in which the car might cause some kind of suffering. First of all, we've got a guy in the automobile driving down the street. He sees his girlfriend on the sidewalk. He waves to her and runs into the back of an MBTA bus. Stopped at the bus stop in front of the university. The metal thuds against metal. There's a huge crash, and what he feels in his bones is dukkha, dukkha. Suffering, suffering, the palpable physical suffering of an automobile accident. That's easy to understand. The second kind of suffering comes if you're attached to that car. Many of the students in the class relate to this. They have automobiles that they love. You take it through the winter in Boston. The winter is cruel up there in New England. There's a lot of salt on the road. There's a lot of ice. People vandalize automobiles. Rust creeps into the parts of the vehicle. The front end becomes unbalanced. As you see the car begin to disintegrate, it causes you suffering in relation to the pleasure, to the attachment that you have invested in that object as it begins to slip away from you. That also is pretty clear. Viparinama dukkha, the suffering that comes from change, is a pretty easy concept to grasp. The third concept is more difficult, and I'm not so sure much of the time that I'm really able to convey it with this example, at least to the students who are sitting in my class at 9 in the morning. But the way you do it is to imagine that person out there in the car, fully invested with all of his ego in this powerful object, roaring up and down the avenue, feeling great surges of pleasure and energy from being in this powerful embodiment, you might say, of his manhood. And ask yourselves whether at that moment he is really happy. Now, if you ask him if he's happy, of course he's going to say yes. The pleasure of that experience is extremely satisfying, and that can't be denied. That's like a physical or emotional sensation that has reality in its own right. But is it real happiness? Is it real satisfaction? I think we know enough about situations like that in our world to begin to question whether that's the place where satisfaction really comes from. In part because it's based on a certain kind of illusion about the nature of the object and an illusion about the nature of the self and how your own ego can become invested in a transient physical object like that that will arise and pass away. So sometimes, in some situations, actually perhaps in many situations, we are suffering in ways that we're not aware of because of illusions that we have about the nature of ourself or about the nature of the objects that populate our world. That seems to me to be what lies behind this third concept, this third type of suffering, the suffering that's due to conditioned states. Now, you can further unravel the doctrinal significance of these three kinds of suffering in Buddhism by relating these three categories to three more concepts, the so-called marks of existence. The first mark is that everything is suffering. The second, that everything is impermanent. This is a different way of saying that everything changes. And the third concept, that everything is, as Buddhists say, no self, or nothing has any self. This third concept is an important one. We might as well learn the Pali for it. It is anatta, no self, and it involves a negation of that old Upanishadic concept of the Atman. Perhaps you can hear it in the word. Atman in Pali becomes atta, A-T-T-A, and you negate it by putting A-N at the beginning. So un-atta means no self. Three doctrinal assertions. Everything is suffering, everything is impermanent, and nothing has a self. Now, obviously, the key concept for us here to take a step deeper into the Buddhist vision of the world is this concept of no self. What does it mean for Buddhists to say that things have no self? Now, the easiest way to step into this concept is to understand that Buddhists are claiming that things have no permanent identity that lasts from one moment to the next. But so by self, what we mean here is not that there's nothing going on. We're here, we're talking, we're conversing about Buddhism in one way or another, mulling over the unfamiliarity of some of these concepts, beginning to grasp and to work with some of their implications. That's all real in a sense, but it's transient. It passes away. We too are transient phenomena. We give an illusion sometimes of some kind of continuity. This lecture series begins with an introductory lecture in which I actually speak my name as if that designated some kind of reality that could remember its experiences in the past and carry those experiences into the future. But the truth is, this personality is constantly changing. It's evolving all the time in big ways, in subtle ways. It's constantly moving. So to say that there is a self here that endures is a certain kind of illusory construction that can cause us pain in certain kinds of situations. So when the Buddhists say that there is no self, what they mean is that there is no permanent identity in things that endures from one moment to the next. This is a basic doctrinal assertion in the Buddhist tradition. So if you like to think doctrinally and philosophically, this is the place to begin to mull over the implications of the Buddha's teaching. Now, if you think about this idea, it poses a bunch of problems for us, a bunch of problems that we would have to discuss and we would have to ponder together. First of all, if there is no self, no permanent identity, what am I? What makes up the human personality? Do Buddhists have an answer to that question? Well, the answer that they give, typically, it's a traditional answer, is that the personality is made up of five aggregates, or khandhas, aggregates, bundles of momentary phenomena, beginning with material form, with rupa, with matter that also has shape, going on through a sequence of categories. I can mention them to you. Matter, sensations, ideas, volitional states, you might say decisions that we make about things, and then finally consciousness, vijnana, the fifth of the aggregates, the consciousness that observes the flow of this causal process. These aggregates are only momentary. Think of them like flickers on a video screen. They're only momentary, but they group together to give the illusion of some kind of continuity or permanence. Buddhists traditionally use two comparisons to express this idea. One is to say that the personality is like the stream of a river, like the flow of a stream. In fact, the word stream is often used to name the personality. The word is santana in Sanskrit. The personality is nothing but a stream of aggregates flowing through the world. Another comparison that they use, quite common, is to think of the personality as a flame, as a fire. This is actually useful because it also suggests at the same time that the personality is burning in a painful way. It's a fire that we fuel by all of the karma that we produce, all the actions that we perform to achieve a certain goal or to avoid a certain unhappy state. And all of that karma is like throwing logs on a great bonfire, and it burns constantly, changing from one moment to the next. So Buddhists think of the personality as flowing like a river and burning like a fire. Now, you can ask another question about the doctrine of no self. This has probably occurred to you, actually, as I speak about this idea. A couple of lectures ago, we talked a lot about reincarnation. about death and rebirth. And the suggestion was that when a person dies, according to the Buddhist view of the world, the soul continues on and is reborn in another body, like the caterpillar that moves from one blade of grass to the next and bears with it its previous karma into another life. Well, that's what Buddhists believe. If there is no self, then what's reborn? Good question. What is it that's reborn if there is no self? The classic answer to this is that it is the stream of causes. It's like the fire. So when death occurs, the previous physical body disintegrates, and the last moment of consciousness, like the last flicker on a candle flame, sets another candle flame in motion. It ignites, what would be the right word? It kindles another candle flame in another body and carries with it that causal process, that causal continuity that establishes some connection between one life and the next. Now, this stream, obviously, is something like a metaphor. It's just a way of speaking about the connection between one moment and the next, because nothing real, nothing permanent, has been carried over into the next life. So this poses another conceptual question about Buddhism. In what sense is it possible to say that I am the same person now that I was 10 minutes ago or in a past life? Obviously, Buddhists would like to assert some kind of identity from one moment to the next, if they can, but it shouldn't be an identity that ties them down too much. It shouldn't assert any kind of permanence, because this permanence dissolves as the personality changes. So here you find in Buddhist texts a very interesting and I think very wise equivocation. It's possible for me to say that I am the same person I was before in a certain kind of metaphorical way, in the same way that I could say that a candle flame that I light in front of me here as I lecture is the same 5 minutes from now as it was when I first lit the candle. When we say that it's the same flame, what we really mean is that there's a causal connection that links the flames. It's not identical. The gases themselves have burned. Something has changed. Sameness is a construct, you might say, a concept that I apply to that flame in order to designate the causal connection that links one moment in the flame to another. So I can speak about myself as being the same person, but it's something like a metaphor, a conventional designation, like the way I designate the identity of a candle flame enduring from one moment to the next. Ultimately speaking, it is not the same flame, and I am not the same person. I have no identity that endures from one moment to the next. So the ultimate Buddhist claim about the nature of the self is that it is transient and constantly changeable. It's the fundamental Buddhist insight about the nature of the world. There is no permanent identity that moves from one moment to the next. And this is about as deep as you can go into the Buddhist concept of suffering. When they say that all is suffering, they mean, of course, that some things are painful. They mean also that some things are impermanent, that all things are impermanent and pass away. But what they mean in the most fundamental sense is that there is no permanent reality that gives anything any identity that endures from one moment to the next. It's the great Buddhist doctrine of no self. So the question that we posed at the very beginning of our discussion about suffering, this question about pessimism, comes down to the doctrine of no self. Are Buddhists pessimistic when they say that there is no self? That's the question. In a way, you could say that they are, because obviously there are lots of things we hold on to in this world that we really like, that are associated in one way or another with this personality we're terribly fond of and anxious to protect. And when that's stripped away, it begins to feel like a negative experience. It can be harsh in some kinds of situations. But it doesn't take too much thought, I think, to realize that it's not so much pessimistic as it's realistic. The truth is, we change. Life passes. The experiences of 6 months ago or 10 years ago are gone. And if we try to hold on to them, they're going to cause us some kind of suffering. And it's this realization that things are impermanent and the ability to let go of stuff that has changed and become part of our past that makes the doctrine of suffering buoyant, light, and easy, and can be expressed in one way or another in that exquisite smile that the Dalai Lama brings to so many of his teachings. To recognize that there is no self in the end is not to lose anything important. It's simply to let go of the frustration and the attachment that brings suffering to this world. And in that sense, this extraordinary claim, all is suffering, becomes a claim about freedom, about buoyancy, about lightness, and about, in the end, nirvana. It's nirvana that will be the topic of our next lecture.